All right. Anyway, there's some handouts right there. Yeah. That's okay. So, I'm definitely not judging anyone who didn't make it here today. Fully understand. But I'm really in awe of the people who did make it here today. That's real dedication. Okay. So before we start today, just a reminder, it's a two-week series, so today's the second part. So next week, we're starting another two-week series on the Kabbalah of animals and the lessons we can learn from them. So, yeah. So normally, we begin with a review. But last week, someone hasn't come yet, but on the way out, someone said to me, I like the way you ask questions and involve the crowd because it makes us think. So I thought, well, if that's the case, instead of reviewing, I'm going to give you a quiz on last week. See how well you're listening. Okay? Don't worry, no pressure. Everything's all right. There's no pass or fail. All right. Okay, so we explained last week how relationships are critical to the world. Two reasons. What are they? Remember? Oh, gosh. Sorry?
Connection.
Ah, connection, yes. Connection and a very important one. Ah, thank you. Good. Sure, I was getting worried there for a minute. Okay. Giving and receiving. Yeah, giving and receiving is the only way that there should be giving and receiving is for there to be relationships which are always built on giving and receiving. Something we've talked about a lot. Okay. Then we talked about the paradox of relationships. Two things have to happen in relationships which seem to be opposite to each other. Anyone remembers? It's okay, don't worry, it's fine. It's... Sorry?
Can you say mistake?
No, the paradox. It's something, the two things, relationships that sort of...
negation of ego.
And good. And, oh, she's got her notes. That's cheating. Okay, no problem, no problem. I don't expect everyone to remember the exact words. It's okay. The negation of ego, but you also have to be present, right? So we explain that because you need presence because you have to be involved in a relationship. No one wants to have a relationship with a nobody. So everyone brings something unique to the relationship. But at the same time, you can't have ego because that destroys and stands in the way of everything that is good for relationships, right? So therefore, we had to develop this idea of how do we balance those two. We talked about Jacob's formula. Jacob's formula was the idea of sheep, right? Remember that Jacob bought sheep. His wealth came from sheep, but then he bought other things with the sheep. Sheep is a symbol of humility and the oxen and donkeys and things like that that he told Esau that he has are more a strength of assertiveness and strength and power. And the concept there was that God wants us to use what we have. He wants us to use our resources and our unique contribution, but it's all got to stem. It's got to be in the context of negation of ego and in the context of humility. So therefore, that's brought out in the whole Jacob formula, that he first got all his wealth through sheep because his foundation was humility. And then with the sheep, he bought other things. He bought those things that symbolize strength because even the strength has to come from humility. And we'll break it down more today in a sort of a practical way. Okay. What I want to do today is explore how this all plays out in healthy relationships. Now again, this is any relationship, by the way, right? Any relationship. But obviously, you know, we talk about strong relationships. There's friends, there's employer-employees, then there's marriage, of course. So it's different. All of them are different, but nevertheless, they all have the same principles. So the concept is like this. When a person works to minimize their ego, right? What's that going to bring practically? What is it going to bring practically? That's the question. What do you think?
Compassion.
What else?
Sorry, repeat the question.
If someone minimizes their ego in your relationship, they try to not center the whole world around themselves, what's going to happen? What will be the results? We're going to explore how it plays out practically, but what's going to be the result? What's the difference between someone who has an ego and doesn't have ego, basically?
Hear what their bodies say.
Yeah, you'll hear someone else. Anyone else? Compassion is certainly one.
You're not selfish,
so you give to the other. Correct, right? By the way, just before we continue, an amazing thing. You know, in the Talmud, there were two schools of learning. Bet Hillel and Bet Shammai. The school of Hillel and the school of Shammai, right? We almost always, whenever there's an argument between the two, and they're both legitimate perspectives in Torah learning, almost always we rule like Bet Hillel, right? And the Talmud says an absolutely fascinating thing, why it was always voted to follow Bet Hillel rather than Bet Shammai. Even though the Talmud says that the school of Shammai were somewhat sharper, actually. I mean, they were both huge Talmudists and unbelievable sages, but the school of Shammai, their learning was a little bit sharper. So why do we go like Bet Hillel? Talmud says a beautiful thing, because when they would teach and they would explain a law and they would suggest the various options of how you can approach the law, they always mentioned Bet Shammai's view first, before their own. The view that they disagreed with. They always mentioned it first and then went on to explain that they don't agree with it and they have a different view. The fact that they always made space in a very emphasized way for Bet Shammai's view be ahead of their own, even though they ended up disagreeing, was reason actually why we always almost rule like them. Because it's an unbelievable, clear instruction of relationships. Making space for others doesn't mean you have to agree with others. Making space for others means that you make space for others. That's exactly what it means. And it means you see another person and you make space. But remember, relationships need presence as well. So it's okay to disagree. In other words, we'll see how that combination plays out practically. But that's the point. You make space for others. So bottom line is this, right? Bottom line is the main point is that when we minimize our ego, which we all have, we result in a viewpoint, in a perspective, in a mindset where it's not always about us, right? So what happens? What happens is you begin to make space for the other person. That's really what it is, making space for another. You begin to value another person. And also you begin to notice another person, right? You notice others. That's really important. When I say notice others, I don't only mean you notice their physical presence in the room. You know your awareness, exactly. You notice what they're feeling, you notice what they want, you notice what they need. You start to pick up on the subtleties, you start to pick up on the nuances, and you start to notice those three things. Now, that can make an unbelievable difference on a practical level. Okay? Those three things, making space for others, valuing others, noticing the other, can have amazing positive consequences in any relationship. And this is now the practical application of what we spoke about last week, the concept of negating the ego being the foundation and yet still being present. So I want to share five things, five ideas, five concepts, and explore them a bit. First one is the idea of needs and wants, right? Sort of explains it itself. But being present in a relationship, it's a two-way street, of course, and people have needs. People have needs. There's sometimes people just need things. And part of a relationship, we know, is to be able to accommodate those needs, know what those needs are, and make room for them and be sensitive to them and appreciate them and accommodate them. Okay. The problem, however, often is when the ego gets mixed in, is that there's like a long list of needs. And where does that come from? Right? When people have huge lists of needs, it's very hard to accommodate them. All of them. Because often needs conflict with each other, right? So if there's a long list, it becomes a source of constant conflict. And I think the way to understand this is a very big difference between needs and wants, right? How would you define the difference? What's a need and what's a want?
A need is essential, a want is a desire.
Right. A want is something you need. You want. It would be nice to have. A need is something you really can't be without, right? The problem is that people with egos have lots of needs. Because when it's all about me, then everything I want becomes a need. Because it's selfish. Everything I want, it's essential. Right? I'm very sensitive. I have to have this. The light has to be on. It has to be off. I don't feel safe. I don't know. All things, right? And every want becomes a need, and then that's a recipe for disaster in relationships, because you can't have 45 needs conflicting with another 45 needs, which often happens. And that leads to relationship breakdown. Right? Minimizing ego means it's not about us. If it's not about us, we start to accommodate the world. And therefore, suddenly we don't need so many things. Everyone has their needs, of course. Everyone has things that they really need. Hopefully when you enter into a relationship, you kind of know what the other person needs also, but not always. Sometimes you learn later. That's fine. But the problem is, the issue is that when you minimize the ego and it's not all about me, then the wants become more, but the needs become less. And once, if you want to accommodate others, wants is something you can compromise on, needs are hard to compromise on. So a person has to know, I don't need a long list of needs, because there's a world around me. I'm not the only person that exists. Obviously, I'm a person, I have needs, and those needs are important, and those needs are important to communicate, as is important for the other person to communicate their needs. But if it's a short list, we can make a plan. We can compromise, we can find a win-win situation, we can seek a solution. But if it's kept down, not if it's a huge list. So that's the first concept. The concept is the concept of needs and wants, and it's an obvious outcome from minimizing ego and negating ego. I'm still here, I'm still important, I'm an individual, I'm not dissolving, but my needs are not that many because I'm making room for the world around me. Okay. The second thing is gratitude, and this is really important. Gratitude is always important in every part of life. But in relationships, it takes on another concept, another level, and that is, first of all, we need to understand that gratitude comes when you notice good. Right? And noticing good, there's different ways of doing that, and it's sometimes very difficult. Why? Because sometimes people don't notice good. They only notice the bad. Right? They only notice what's wrong. And what's fascinating is that this is very much linked to ego. Why? Because narcissists, and I'm using a very extreme term now, but anyone with a good ego, ego's always bad, but a sizable ego, right? If it doesn't work for me, then it's all bad. Because my world's the only world. So anyway, it's the story I've told you many times about Haman, right? He comes out of the palace and everything's amazing. He's been promoted to prime minister and he's going to this banquet with the king and the queen and the whole thing. And then when one old Jew won't bow down to him, his whole world falls apart. Why? Because the world runs around an egocentric person. And if any part of that world that he encounters doesn't work for him or her, the world falls apart. Right? So therefore, that's an impossible mindset to have when you talk about a relationship. Because no one is perfect. Except for the person who has ego, thinks they're perfect. But the world is not perfect. And therefore, there's going to be flaws in everyone that you encounter, every single person. So one of the ideas to manage that, to navigate that, is to start reflecting on, hold on a second, yes, I don't particularly like that aspect, but there's lots of good. There's lots of good there. We have to notice the good. And nothing has to be perfect, because I'm not perfect either. Therefore, I've got flaws, you've got flaws, we'll manage. If we notice the good that is there in each other, right? I saw a video just a few days ago. And I thought, it's perfect for this year. Right? About gratitude. There's a chapter in Tehillim, a chapter in Psalms, which is known as the Psalm of Gratitude. Mizmor L'Todah. It's a short psalm. It's chapter 100. Right? And it's a beautiful thing. In fact, some people say it every day. Some people say it often because they want to imbue the trait of gratitude within themselves. And this guy who was giving that particular shiur, he said this point. Gratitude means not everything is perfect. Gratitude means you start noticing the good and you become grateful for the things that are good, even though it's not perfect. And he said, he was talking in Hebrew, so he said, it's a difference between, doesn't have to be always be a kos male, which means a full cup. It can be a half a cup, and the half a cup is still half full. And half full, that perspective, that optimism and that positive perspective becomes the way that you reach gratitude, because it's what I have. Before I come back to this, I just saw another video. It's not that I spend all my day looking at videos, but they pop up on WhatsApp, right? So there's a camp that there's a camp in. I try to look for the positive ones at least. I mean, many of us are not cut out because I'm not interested in looking at them. Especially if they're from the media, normally, right? With all the blood libels and the lies that are happening. But anyways, there's a lot of positive stuff still. So there's a camp in America, a beautiful camp called Camp Simcha. It's summer in America now, right? And it's a religious camp, and they accommodate, but not only religious kids, they accommodate people. It's a camp for Jewish kids, and they accommodate people with disabilities who have gone through sickness. And it's a very, very amazing, amazing camp. Like,
my
real.
Son went there.
Sorry?
One of my sons went there.
Ah, right, okay. Oh, good. So you know about it, right?
Yeah.
And it's got a beautiful name. It's called Camp Simcha. And the counselors there are amazing. Like, they're all happy, and they dance with the kids. I mean, it's like an amazing place, right? So there was someone went there, made a bunch of videos, and there's one particular young man there. I don't know what the background to it is, but he only has one arm, unfortunately. But a very upbeat guy. So the guy doing the interview says to him, "Do you have a message for the world?" He says, "Sure." He says, "The way I live," he says, "I don't define myself with the fact that I'm lacking an arm. I wake up every morning and say to myself, I've got one arm, I've got two legs, I can see, I can think, there's lots I can do." He's missing an arm. I mean, missing an arm is a big deal. It's a huge deal. But that's not what he focuses on. He focuses on the good. It's an amazing thing. So back to the chapter of Tehillim. So he says, you've got to look at the half full cup, even if it's half full. And he said the following, an amazing thing about this chapter in Tehillim, chapter 100. He says, what's the gematria, what's the numerical value of cup, kos? Kos, a cup, is in Hebrew is a kos, right? Like we have on Kiddush for Anad, we make it on a kos, or Pesach, we drink four cups of wine, it's called Dalit Kosot, right, the four cups. It said the numerical value of kos is 86, right? The gematria is 86. What's half a cup then? 43. In Mizmor Letada, in the chapter of Tehillim, that is the chapter of thanks, there's 43 words. Half a cup. It's a lesson in how you're supposed to have gratitude. And when we talk about other people, it's such an amazing lesson, right? Because we've got to be able to focus on the good. We sometimes hone in on what is bad. And that just destroys relationship. It creates conflict, you know. You're always late. Okay, but it's a kind person, an amazing person. I wasn't talking to anyone, by the way. I was just looking your direction, but you're not late.
What about always early?
Always early. Anyway, it's annoying. You're always late. What do you mean? Person's always late. Okay, but I know you don't like it because you're a very punctual person. But you know what this person is? If you take out a piece of paper and write 10 good things about the person, you'll see it's an amazing human being. That's what we need to. Why? Because again, egocentricity results in imperfection being a problem. But when I know that if you engage in humility and you know that you're not perfect, you have a lot of flaws, the other person has a lot of flaws, and therefore the way you resolve that is by looking at the positive, it's an ingredient to enhance and make relationships stronger. Which leads to another concept, and that is not to be judgmental, right? We reach conclusions, we jump at conclusions. So I've shared this with you many, many years ago, I think. If you have a look up there, there's a Pirkei Avot, something from the Ethics of the Fathers, where it talks about the importance of judging people favorably, right? So it's just to refresh your memory. So it's a beautiful phrase. It says, "V'heve dan et kol ha'adam lekafschot." Judge each person favorably. Now, there's a whole discussion what that means. We've given shiurim in the past. But there's one interesting nuance here. In Hebrew, if you want to say judge everyone favorably, you will say heve dan, which means judge, et kol adam, every person. Lekaf sechut, favorably. Okay? But it doesn't say that. It says heve dan, judge et kol ha'adam, judge the whole person. Kol adam means every person. Kol ha'adam means the whole person. And the commentaries say a very beautiful thing, that the only way to judge someone favorably is, like we said before, you've got to look at the whole person. Look at the whole person, right? Sometimes you enter in a relationship, it could be you find a teacher and it's amazing and very caring. And then 5 years later, you discover that the guy's not perfect. Right? He's got some flaws. So we cancel them, right? That's the common culture. No good. But you spent a really good time with him. I mean, you entered in this relationship. It could be marriage, it could be everything. Right? The children, the same thing. You want to judge favorably, it has to be have done a kol ha'adam. Have a look at the whole person. Okay? Number four is empathy. When you have a less ego, you start to notice the other. This is a very simple concept. You start to notice the nuances and you start to strengthen the relationship on so many levels. There's a general problem today. I've mentioned this before. There was a study out in New York that empathy has declined generally, not only because of relationship issues or ego issues, but because of the smartphone and all the other devices, because we're not noticing people. We're just looking at our phones. Okay, that's another practical problem. So we need to practically and physically make time and effort and investment to actually notice other people. But there's a deeper thing, of course. If we're wrapped in ourselves, we don't notice other people. But if we're not wrapped in ourselves, we notice, we make space for the other. We value the other. So we start noticing the other, right? I want to just cite a few examples of people who... Yeah. Oh, can go? Thank you. There we go. Okay. You know, I think I've told you this before, but Joseph, one of my favorite stories in the Chumash, of course, is the story of Yosef. Because it's just a model of so many things that we talk about. One of the stories of Yosef being chucked into Egypt and sold down to slavery and so on, he eventually lands up in jail, right? And in jail he is, there with the butler and the baker of Pharaoh's, you know, the famous story. And ultimately they become, the butler gets killed, but the baker gets killed, but the butler goes out of jail before him. And eventually, because Pharaoh had bad dreams, he remembered that Joseph had interpreted his dreams, and he was the one to get Joseph out of Egypt. And within a very short time, Pharaoh was so impressed with Joseph that he took him from being a prisoner and he made him the viceroy of Egypt, right? And that was the whole story of Joseph being able to sustain his father and his brothers and his family and bring them down to Egypt. And that's the whole history of Am Yisrael. How did it all happen? It happened, listen carefully, it happened from noticing someone. Mm-hmm. What happened was, says the Chumash, four words. Joseph wakes up in the morning. He's in the jail, became very popular in jail. But he's in the jail and he comes into the room. Everyone had woken up in the morning. And he sees the butler and the baker looking very distressed. That's it. And he says four words. He says to them, Madua pneichem ra'im hayom. Yeah. Why is your face bad today? In other words, why do you look like something's bothering you? He noticed that someone was bothered. And when he noticed someone was bothered, they opened up. And they told him, because we had really distressing dreams, puzzling dreams last night. We don't know what they mean. We don't know if they're good or bad. So he says, tell me your dreams. Maybe I can help you. And they do. Unfortunately for the baker, the interpretation of his dream wasn't so great. It was actually that Pharaoh was going to have him killed soon. Okay, that wasn't good news. But for the butler, it was that in 3 days' time, Pharaoh is going to take you out of the jail and restore you to your original post of being his butler. And then 2 years later, Pharaoh, and he actually asked the butler a favor to mention him to Pharaoh. The butler forgot. But 2 years later, when Pharaoh had bad dreams and everyone was in disarray because Pharaoh was agitated, and he says, you've got to find someone who can interpret his dreams. They bring some dream interpreters and they all spoke nonsense. Pharaoh could tell that. And they were just making it up, so he knew that wasn't right. And then he says, who can do it? No one could do it. And the butler comes and says, I'm sorry to bring up my past sins, but I don't know if you remember, I was in jail 2 years ago, and there we had dreams, and this guy was unbelievable, this Jewish person, this Hebrew person, he called him Na'ar Ivri, a young Hebrewite, what do you call him? And he was able to do it, and he says, bring him right here. And within a half a day, after you interpret Pharaoh's dreams about the years of famine and the years of plenty and all that, and he gave Pharaoh some good sound advice of what to do, Pharaoh said, you're amazing. You're the viceroy of Egypt and you take over. And the rest was history. Why? Because he noticed, how did it all happen? He could have been languishing in jail for years. But he noticed someone was bothered. He said, Madua pneichem ra'im hayom. But when you notice someone is bothered, you look out, you ask them how they are, and you lift them up. And you make them feel good. You nurture them. That's what empathy is. Putting yourself in the other person's world. But you can only put yourself in the other person's world if you're not locked and wrapped up in your own world. Right? I don't know if I've told you the story, but I heard this from a old Hasid called Rabbi Weinberg. He used to come to South Africa quite often. And he told me and my family the following story. He was quite close to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he once had a very urgent thing to ask the Rebbe about. The problem was the Rebbe was in his office and the secretaries had gone home already. I don't know why, it's interesting, because normally it wasn't like that. Whenever the Rebbe was there, the secretaries were there, but that was the story. So he went, and you couldn't just open the Rebbe's door, you weren't allowed to do that. So he went, and he put an envelope in like the Rebbe's, like a crack in the door or something, and he hoped that the Rebbe opens the door, he'll find the envelope. And he kind of hid to see what was going to happen. But he didn't actually work it out correctly, because what happened was, the Rebbe opened the door, and the envelope dropped to the ground. So the Rebbe had to bend down and pick up the envelope, and he felt very bad that he made the Rebbe bend down to pick up an envelope. Within a minute, it was an urgent question, within an hour there was an answer, and he was okay. But he wrote another letter to the Rebbe, profusely apologizing for making the Rebbe bend down and pick up the envelope. I mean, the Rebbe was very revered, and that wasn't something a chassid wanted to do, and he apologized. So out came the answer, so the Rebbe responded to that also. And he said a very beautiful thing. I'll say it to you in Hebrew first, but and it was Hebrew and Yiddish, a mixture. And I'll translate it. The Rebbe said, no need to apologize. Which means, no need to apologize because behold, my whole definition is to lift up, to lift others up. So lifting up the envelope was a part of that, part of his job definition, right? Because that was one of the great things about the Rebbe, about noticing. Noticing individuals, besides being amazingly, tremendously busy with very, very global things, but the individual, to pick up an individual, the many, 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 many stories around that was amazing. But actually, I want to tell you a couple of stories, but not about the Rebbe, but about his Rebbetzin. Can I go to this? Yeah? No. Right? I'll just give you a bit of context. The Rebbe's wife was very different. The Rebbe's wife had a different path, meaning she was not a public figure. She was an extremely modest person, hugely intelligent. But I think the idea was that she wouldn't have a life if she was public. Everyone would want to see her and connect with her. So she was extremely private. And there were a number of individuals that did have a connection with her. I'm not sure the background to this, but the Gerari family, for some reason, had a connection to her. Maybe it had to do with the Rebbe's brother-in-law, who was also a cousin of ours and what. So I had actually the great merit of actually going to the Rebbetzin's house 3 times in my life and visited her. Once with my grandfather when I was bar mitzvah, once when my brother got married, my older brother, and once when I got married. Of course, Dina came with me, and she always talks about the one time that she saw the Rebbetzin. And she was an amazing, and my parents always, when they visit New York, or my grandfather would always make an appointment. There was many, many people like that, but it wasn't an open thing. There were many people when I grew up that had never seen the Rebbetzin even, right? But she was an amazing, amazing woman and amazingly sensitive to others, incredibly sensitive to others. And I've just been thinking about it lately, so I want to just share with you a couple of stories, which really, it's about noticing, right? And about remembering the other person, noticing the other person, and remembering what makes another person happy and so on. So there's a video, I didn't hear from the person himself, but there's a video that was a girl that had become religious. In New York, there's a seminary called Machon Chana. Machon Chana is specifically for girls who didn't have a background, and they come to New York, they want to come close, they want to learn about more Jewish wisdom, whatever the case is, and they join the seminary. But often what happens is they're away from their family. Often their family are not that supportive of what they're doing because they've taken a path to become more connected to Judaism and so on. And this girl was one day feeling pretty down. Like she didn't have family in Crown Heights as the, like I had a lot of family. Like when I was in Yeshiva there, a lot of family there, wasn't a problem, right? But these people don't often because it's just their family's not from there, not from that community. And she didn't really have her to talk to. She didn't feel she can talk to someone that would really understand her. So she had this crazy idea. I can't find someone, I'm going to go to the top. I'm going to the top. So she writes a letter to the Rebbetzin. She says, I know you're not very private, you're very busy, but me and a few girls, she shared it with a few friends, they're also in the same dilemma. We'd love to see you. They go to the Rebbe's house, make sure no one's looking, put the thing in the letterbox and run away. 2 days later, the cook in the seminary, her name was, I forgot the name, but I think like an old Russian woman who for some reason had a very close connection with the Rebbetzin as well. She calls this girl and says, did you write a letter to the Rebbetzin? So now she freezes. Oh boy, I'm in trouble, right? Yeah. So she says, yeah. The Rebbetzin would like to see you and your friends. Like to meet with you. So she tells the story in the most beautiful way. So they go. They go with the cook. cook was very close, and the cook was showing her pictures of some of the weddings that were happening, the girls that got married. And then the Rebbe starts to talk to these people. And what does she say to them? She knows the situation. She knows they're getting involved in learning and Yiddishkeit. She didn't ask anything about Yiddishkeit. She said to them, what are your hobbies? She wanted to know, each girl, like, what's your hobbies? And they all went through and they thought it was amazing. What music do you guys like to hear? Right? She went around each girl, like, what do you... Why? Because she knew... She right away picked up. She knew where to get them. She knew how to make them feel welcome. How to make them feel they're cared for. Right? And she said, it was just the most amazing experience. It wasn't about spirituality. It wasn't about anything. They obviously knew there was girls feeling a bit lonely. They wanted, and there was someone there that would care about them and be interested in them. And be interested in their hobbies, interested in their music. The Rebbetzin was Rebbetzin. She was worried about big things, but big spiritual things. But these are the things she asked because she noticed that was the spot. They needed someone to take an interest in them. Not what they had recently started learning, but an interest in them. I don't know if I've told you a personal story with the Rebbetzin, which is an amazing story. And I don't know if I've told you this before, but it was an incredible story. The last time we saw the Rebbetzin, it was 1987, just after me and Dina and I got married. And we went to visit the Rebbetzin. It was myself and Dina, my parents, both my parents, and my younger sister, who's, when I say younger sister, she's the baby in the family. I mean, she's a grandmother, but she was like 11 at the time or something. Yeah, 11, 12, something like that. And same thing, the Rebbetzin was interested in everyone. In fact, one little story, funny story, actually, nothing to do with the story I want to tell. But she turned to me, she was talking to my parents first. She was always very interested in what was going on in South Africa. And lots of, she was a very, very cultured person, a very intelligent person, very well understood world affairs. She was amazing, amazing human being. But then she turned to me and she says, so what are you going to do? So with a touch of youthful arrogance, and at that time the Rebbe was making a big campaign about people going out in Shlichut, going out to various countries and towns and spreading Yiddishkeit, called Shlichus, right? I said to the Rebbetzin, like very, I reflected on it later, it was like very like assertive. I said to her, well, I'm going to learn and study in the Kollel for a few months and I'm going to go on Shlichus. And she turned to me and she says, Shlichus is very hard. And I think she put me in my place. And which was okay, it was necessary. But I don't realize later exactly what she meant. It's like, not all, you know, Shlichus, you're a big shot. No, it's actually hard work. All right. But then she turned to my younger sister and she says, Nu, how do you like America? So my mother, for some reason, decided to answer for her, and like with Jewish mothers. And she said to the Rebbetzin, oh, she loves America because in South Africa at that time you couldn't get all the kosher chocolates and all the national stuff like that. In America you could, right? I remember as a kid growing up, kosher chocolates came once a year before Pesach in what do they call them? In Checkers and in Pick and Pay and things like that, right? So the Rebbetzin heard that. Right away she called, there was someone in the house that used to help out. His name was Halberstam. She says, Halberstam, she calls him. Go to the cupboard and bring out a nice box of chocolates and give it to her. She gave my sister a chocolate. It was very amazing. All happy, and it was very thoughtful of her. Fast forward now, 1988. This is less than a year later. The Rebbetzin was, when we saw the last time, she was already very frail. She was late 80s. She was frail. She was not so well. And so we were told only we can only stay half an hour, whatever. But then, and she got worse. And this happens now, 2-3 months before she passes away. She was really not well. And the first group of Bokharim come to South Africa. It was a yeshiva there. And they brought out like 10 Bokharim to study there. One of them, his name was Menachem Yunik. And he, your brother knows him very well. He's now in England. And he, as a Bokhar, the whole Yunik family, they were very close to the Rebbetzin because they used to help out in the house. They used to do things for the Rebbetzin and he used to help the Rebbe. Lots of things. He took care of a lot of things, the father. And the children were all, like they used to go and visit the Rebbetzin very often. They were from their family. So he decided, Menachem Yunik decided, that before he goes to South Africa, he was going to go and visit the Rebbetzin and say goodbye. So he goes to the Rebbetzin and he says, I'm going on Shlichus as a Bokhar. I'm going to help out the yeshiva there. I'm going to Johannesburg. He says, oh, you're going to Johannesburg. Can you do me a favor? Can you take a package to the Geraris? No. My parents get a message that it's a package coming from the Rebbetzin. They say, what can the Rebbetzin possibly be sending us? They go to the airport to welcome this guy to get the package as soon as possible. They open it up, it's 2 boxes of chocolates. Right? This is what the Rebbetzin had in her mind 8 months later. Very frail, very sick. But she remembered that young girl in South Africa that never had a good life, but never couldn't get the milk, the good milchika chocolates in South Africa, because they didn't have it yet, and they could only get it in New York. Yeah, that's what I mean about noticing other people, right? I'll tell you one more unbelievable story about how she thought of others. Once, for Shabbos, often in the later years, because it was hard for the Rebbe to walk from his home to 770, they used to come for Shabbos and stay next door to 770. There was a big library there, and there was a room dedicated to them, and they used to stay there. And one time, and Motzei Shabbos, she also used to leave, she always used to go from the back, no one said see her, she was very, very discreet that way. And one time, a bocher was running to the back, a young student, and by mistake, he bumped into someone from the back, and he realized that it was the Rebbe. And he was deadly embarrassed, right? The Rebbe didn't see him, but he was just felt so bad. And after a few days, he was just feeling so bad. So he wrote a letter to the Rebbe. Again, apologizing, amazing. Why? I'm sorry, didn't know what it was. I didn't realize he was in a rush. He was running. It was a terrible thing. He bumped into it, and he's really upset, and he's apologizing. So the Rebbe, I think, contacted him or wrote him back a letter or something like that. And she said, I'm really upset that you asked that you apologize, because I was so happy that I didn't see who it was. So that, in other words, that the person should know that the Rebbetzin knew that he bumped in, that would be devastating for the person. And I didn't want to know who it was, and I was so happy I never saw. And now you've told me who you are, and that's making me upset. Anyway, that was the idea, right? Just like, you know, these like sensitivity. So I'm just bringing that all in because empathy, but that comes from, she was the most amazingly humble person. In everything, in every way, like very, very refined, very humble, and hugely sensitive to others. Hugely sensitive to others. So that's empathy, minimizing ego leads to empathy. But the last thing I want to talk about is a hard one, and that's criticism. Why? Because easy to say, don't criticize. But that's actually wrong. Because sometimes you do need to criticize in any relationship. Right? Positive feedback is a good thing. It's a good thing to give sometimes. It's a good thing to take sometimes, right? But it's really hard to take. People get very, very uptight, right? Why? Why is that? I haven't bothered you for a few minutes. So tell me, why is criticism so difficult? Like, as we react, what feelings does it make? What does it do?
Anger.
Yeah. Sorry? You feel under attack, okay. What else?
Shame.
Shame, attacked.
Sad,
insecure, yeah. So most human beings, when they get criticized, they get their back up and their defenses up, and they take it really, really hard, right? The problem, however, is that in all relationships, we have to have hard conversations sometimes. Because if someone is doing something I'm not even aware of, and they're just doing something that's really making me a problem or compromising my needs or very offensive, it's not good just to sit with it. Because sit with it is not going to have a good outcome. We know that, right? So therefore, we do need to give some feedback sometimes, and we actually do need to criticize sometimes, right? Wasn't it working? Wasn't that good? Actually, need the next one. All right, doesn't matter. We'll work it out. So the question is, and also it goes back to what we said last week. A relationship, we have to negate ego, but we can't disappear. And if there's something really important, right? If there's something really important that's bothering me, I need to find a way to share it with the other person. But I got to share it with a way that won't get the person's defenses up. In other words, I got to share it in a way where it's in the context of humility, where I take into account that person's feelings. So it's got to happen, right? Sharing criticism is part of me, part of being me being present in the relationship. But it's got to be without ego. It's got to be... Will this work now? No, this thing's not working. You know, can you just put in the next one?
Yes.
No, next one even? Okay, that's it. That's one and even. Okay, thanks. That's all. The rest will matter to that. Okay. Right, you understand what I'm saying? Because if it comes from arrogance and it's about me, so I'm screaming at you, I'm telling you bluntly how I feel. And I see, you know, some people say, I'm going to be honest, I'm just going to be blunt, I'm going to share what I... It doesn't work, because it's about me then. It's about me, it's not going to be received well. It has to happen, but it has to be with taking into account the feelings of the other person and the context of the other person. And therefore it's got to come in a certain context. So I want to share with you an amazing formula. What I call, last time I called it Jacob's sheep. This time I'm going to call it Moses' rebuke. In fact, it's this week's parsha, this week's weekly portion. And I'm using the commentaries. It's a beautiful idea. I didn't make it up myself. I heard it from my wife. She shared it with me. So she sometimes gives me really, really great tips for the shiurim. And it's got based on this week's parasha. So what happens in this week's parasha? Let me just give you the context. This week's parasha begins with, it's the end of, last week, with the end of the first four books of the Chumash. And this week, it's Moshe Rabbeinu talking. And it's a big monologue. It's a big drasha. You know, some people, they go to shul, they upset about the rabbi's long drasha. It happens, right? This one, well, you think it's so long. It's not that long, the drasha that your rabbi gives. It's not as long as Moshe Rabbeinu's drasha, Moses' drasha. Moses spoke for 37 days. Right? We have a whole chumash. It was 37 days before he passed away. And, okay, they went to sleep also, and they ate the man and so on. They took breaks. But he spoke for 37 days to go through the entire Torah again, to repeat the Torah, to give them a pep talk and inspiration as they go into Israel, and so on and so forth. And the pasuk begins the following. What he does is, he starts off with actually a reprimand. He starts off rebuking the people. How so? So let's have a look at the first verse, which is a very strange verse. The first verse says, well, I'm going to read part of it to you. It says, Eile hadvarim. These are the things, these are the words that Moshe Rabbeinu spoke to the Jewish people. And look what happens. It lists all, where were the Jewish people? This is what the pasuk seems to be saying. Where were the Jewish people? Bamidbar, they were in Be'ever HaYarden. So they were the other side of the Jordan before they went into Israel. And it says they were Bamidbar, they were in the desert. They were in a place called Arava. Mol Suf, which is the opposite, it's facing the Red Sea. Bein Paran u'Bein Tofel. It's between Paran and a place called Tofel. V'Lavan and Lavan. Also the Chatzerot. It was Chatzerot. V'Di Zahav and a place called Di Zahav. Now first of all, you can't mean so many places at once. That's number one, right? As the commentaries point out, as Rashi brings. Second of all, actually, some of these places don't exist. They made up names. So what does this mean? The only place they were was, in the first one, which isn't on this list, they were in Eiver HaYarden. They were on the other side of the Jordan. That's exactly right. That's where they're about to go into Israel. Right? They weren't facing the Red Sea. There's no such place that's called Tofel or Di Zahav. There's no such place. So, let me explain to you what this is all about. Actually, what Moshe Rabbeinu was doing, he was criticizing them. He was reminding them of the things they did wrong and they need to learn not to do it again. But he did it cryptically. And actually, he actually criticized them in a way that's got five ideas, five methods of criticism which made it effective. What's Arava? Where's that place, Arava? Yeah, Arava, you see, okay. Rashi doesn't explain it in... Oh, no, maybe he does, hold on. 1 second. Okay. Sorry. Bamidbar in the desert. Now, they weren't in the desert. They'd already come to the other side of the Jordan, which actually wasn't a desert. It was about what they did in the desert. When they complained and they said, you know, it's so difficult here, we need to go back to Egypt. That's what he was pointing out. So he's reminding them about what they did in the Midbar, right? Then he says, Arava. What's Arava? Arava was a place that they sinned in with idol worship and adultery. There was a place, you know, when Bilam couldn't curse the Jewish people, he got the king to, he says, you know what, I'll give you a different way of destroying the Jewish people. Get them to sin. Get them to serve idols, to be involved in morality and so on. Mol Suf. What's Suf? They weren't next to the Red Sea. He was reminding them about what they did when they came to the Red Sea, that they got panicked and they started telling Moshe Rabbeinu, what are you doing to us? What, there weren't enough graves in Egypt? We just go back, right? And they didn't trust God. Paran, Tofel, Lavan, what's that all about? It says because it was about the time that they complained about the man. They were in Paran and they complained. Tofel means to complain. Lavan is white because the color of the man, the manna that fell every day was white. And the Jews had enough. They, you know, they were complaining about it. We don't have proper food, meat and all that kind of stuff. You're giving us this white stuff. And they complained about it and God wasn't happy. Right? Paran was also the place that the spies went. And he was reminding him about the spies, how they messed up. Then there's Chatzerot. Chatzerot was the place where there was a rebellion of Korach, right? And then finally, Dizahav, the place of gold. There's no such place. He's reminding them about, D means enough. Like they had so much gold. What did they end up doing? They ended up making a golden calf. Okay. And then when he finishes all that, he gives them a huge blessing. He says, Yosef Hashem Aleichem Kachem. Hashem should add to you the more blessings than he's given you till now. And you should be completely blessed and so on and so forth. So putting together many of the commentaries, what's actually happening is an amazing thing. It's actually a formula for effective criticism, for effective constructive feedback that takes into account the feelings, the emotions, the dignity of the other person. And it goes like this. The first thing is, and this is pointed out by the Maharal in his commentary called the Gur Aryeh, on which he has on Rashi. Gur Aryeh is the Hebrew form of Gur Aryeh, of course. Right? So in his he has a commentary on Rashi and explains the following. He says, the first thing you do when you criticize is, you first have to build the person up. You have to show that you care for them. Moshe Rabbeinu waits all the way till 37 days before he passed away to do this because he spent 40 years caring for them, being dedicated for them. They loved Moshe Rabbeinu. They didn't want him to die. That's clear from different verses. Even though they complain sometimes, as children do, but they loved Moshe Rabbeinu. Why? Because they knew that he was absolutely dedicated to them. He wasn't rebuking them because of his arrogance, because of his egocentricity, because of his feelings, because of his frustration. He was criticizing them because he really cared for them. Number one. Number two, another reason why Moshe Rabbeinu waited to do it much, much later in the game is because one of the things, this is a mistake people make so badly, one of the things that you have to avoid when you give criticism is repetition. Don't keep nagging every day and saying, I told you, and you always do this. That's never, ever received well. Moshe Rabbeinu, the lady says, I'm not going to do it again. I'm doing it now, and that's it. Because I don't want to repeat it. I want to send you the message, and I want you to absorb the message, but I don't want to nag you with this, because I know it's not going to work, right? Number three, it's got to be with dignity. Without humiliation. How does Moshe Rabbeinu do that? That's why I just went through the whole thing with you. All these places. He didn't spell it out. People aren't stupid. He reminded them. He said, he hinted. Chatzerot, Dizahav. Right? And so on. So he did it very, very subtly. Why? To preserve their dignity. Criticism is never good when it compromises the dignity of the other person. Again, this is all part of, it's not because of me. It's because I care for you and I care for our relationship. Because if it's me, I'll just do anger and I'll just, that's what happens when there's ego. You just broadcast your feelings and it's not constructive, it's not effective. The fourth one is a very fascinating one. I'll just give you a couple of examples. In Moshe Rabbeinu's rebuke, he sends him a message. And the message is, I am rebuking, I'm reprimanding you for the things you did wrong, but I understand you. I understand why you did those things. That's such an amazing trait. I get it. Let me give you three quick examples. It's getting late. He reminded them when they complained about the man, and he calls it Lavan. I mean, he could have done other hints for the Lavan, for the man. He didn't do that. He calls it Lavan, white. He says, I understand you. The most boring experience to eat the same white cracker every single day. White represents, there's no color, there's no interest, there's no details. I mean, you know, after a while you get bored of the same food. He says, I get it, I understand you. He says, you made a golden calf because you had too much gold. I understand you. It's the test of affluence. It's a test of having too much. And when you have too much, sometimes you abuse it. I get it, but it was wrong. He says, things you did in the desert, Bamidbar, I get you because traveling in the desert was hard. Because the Torah tells us later that it was a fierce desert. There were snakes, there were scorpions, it was Hagadol Vandera, it was a fierce desert. It was an awesome desert, meaning it was like overwhelming. So I get that you complain. It was a difficult position to be in. And the others go like, I lost, I won't go through all of them. But criticism, when it comes in the context of, I understand you, but I respect you so much that I expect better from you. It's a very different thing. It's like so important, like in parenting, but in all relationships. I understand you, but you can do better. It's a very different thing, like that you're just nobody. You know what I'm saying? You're useless. That's a very different message. And finally, what does Moshe Rabbeinu do afterwards? He says, I did reprimand you, but I didn't define you by that, because I love you. Right after he finishes, he praises them and he blesses them. He said, I want you, I don't want to replace you. That's not why I rebuked you. It's because I want you, because of your greatness, your neshama, your worth, your real value. Therefore, Hashem Yosef Alechem, Hashem should add blessing, not to someone else, to you, because I want you. It's like that sandwich, right? You've got to be able to start with something positive, end with something positive, but with care and real concern in sending the message. And that's the formula to criticize, and that's when it's effective. But again, it all comes what we spoke about last week. It's about you, whenever you do something in a relationship, you've got to make that decision. You make that choice, actually. Is it about me, or am I making space for the other person? Is my assertiveness, the sense of self, my contribution, my unique contribution to this relationship, which is important, but is it based on humility? Meaning it's based on making space for the other, taking into account the other, noticing the feelings of other, making sure that they're not damaged in the process, then it's always effective. If it's coming just because of me and from my ego, it's always not effective. And that's the key, essentially, the summary key to all healthy relationships. So, thank you for that. That's the end of this short series. Again, next week, remember, a new series, The Kabbalah of Animals. Have a wonderful week.